Welcome back to the Deep Dive. We're here to take on the complex stuff, the heavy research, so you can get straight to the core ideas.
And today we're tackling something that, well, it feels less like looking back at old philosophy and much more like reading a prediction for right now.
Yeah, it really does. We're diving deep into Jean-François Lyotard's book from 1979, The Postmodern Condition. A report on knowledge.
Right. And think about that date, 1979. I mean, this is way before personal computers were everywhere, long before the internet as we know it, definitely before AI became this huge force in culture and tech.
Incredible foresight.
It really is, because The sources you gave us, they show Lyotard basically mapping out the challenges we're wrestling with today. Things like, you know, who decides what knowledge is legitimate? How does technology dominate us? Is truth itself changing?
So our mission today isn't just an academic exercise. Mm-hmm. We're trying to use Lyotard, almost like a decoder ring, for our current moment.
Exactly. We need to grasp how he saw the rules changing, the foundations of science and society shifting as we moved into what he called the postmodern age.
And connect that directly to our world, a world increasingly run by machine learning, massive data systems, and this constant push for, well, efficiency.
Okay, so where do we start? We have to begin with Lyotard's, let's say, very famous, maybe overly simplified definition of what postmodernism is.
Right, the big one.
He defines it simply as incredulity toward meta-narratives.
Incredulity, yeah. Just not believing anymore. And meta-narratives, that's the absolute key term here, isn't it?
It is. These are the grand stories, the unifying explanations. Think of them like master keys that were used for centuries to legitimize knowledge, society, progress, everything.
But Lyotard says we just stopped buying them. We lost faith. So what were these huge stories that he says basically fell apart?
He points to two main ones, two colossal narratives that really propped up the whole modern way of thinking. First, there's what he calls the speculative narrative. You often connect this with thinkers like Hegel. It's the idea that history is this single unified journey, the dialectic of the spirit, always marching towards complete knowledge, towards self-realization.
So the belief was that if we just keep learning more, discovering more science, history itself will naturally lead us to wisdom. And justice.
That's the core idea, yeah. It basically guaranteed that searching for truth automatically meant you were also pursuing what's right and just. The second big one was the narrative of emancipation.
Right, the story of freedom.
Exactly. This one paints humanity as the hero, you know, battling ignorance, fighting oppression, using science and reason to achieve liberty, freedom for the individual, freedom for the worker, eventually leading to universal peace.
Big, sweeping, optimistic stories.
Very optimistic. And Lyotard's point is that both of these narratives, the very stories that justified our big institutions like the state, the university, science itself, they've lost their power. They don't work anymore as the ultimate source of legitimacy for truth or justice. We just can't tell those stories with a straight face now.
Okay, so if those grand narratives, those foundations are gone, if we're skeptical about inevitable progress towards total knowledge or universal freedom, what rushes in to fill that vacuum? What's the defining feature of this new postmodern reality he describes?
Well, that's his central hypothesis right there in chapter one. He says the fundamental status of knowledge itself is changing as societies move into this post-industrial, postmodern era.
And technology is the engine driving this change. Absolutely. He pinpoints three key technological pillars: informatics, cybernetics, and what he called advanced language techniques. Basically, computation, systems control, and the sophisticated ways we use language and symbols in technology.
Yeah.
So we're shifting from a world governed by philosophical stories
to one where knowledge is processed, controlled, and valued almost entirely through the lens of technology. That's the big shift. Hashtag tag I die. Knowledge is commodity and the reign of performativity.
Okay, let's really unpack that shift, because this feels like the part of Lyotard's report that just leaps off the page for anyone living today. If knowledge isn't primarily about emancipation or enlightenment anymore, what does it become in this new technological landscape?
It becomes a commodity, pure and simple, and the transformation is pretty brutal. For knowledge to even function in these new channels, remember, this is 1979, the dawn of the information age. It has to be translated.
Translated into what?
Into quantities of information, into bits, data.
And right there, that's the link to AI, isn't it? The prerequisite for training any model.
It's exactly that. Lyotard explicitly predicts this. He says any aspect of knowledge that can't be translated into bits, anything that resists being quantified, structured, processed by a machine, it's going to be sidelined. It'll be discarded.
So if you can't measure it, digitize it, feed it into the system, it just doesn't count.
Essentially, yes, it loses its value within this new framework. He even argued that new research would inevitably be shaped by whether or not it could be translated into machine language. The medium dictates the message in a way.
That sounds like a massive loss, a systemic erasure of anything qualitative, anything deeply humanistic that resists easy measurement. It is a huge loss. He specifically points to the decline of this old, very important principle. The idea that acquiring knowledge is fundamentally tied to forming the mind, the person, the German ideal of Bildung. Bildung, that's about holistic development, right? Creating an enlightened person, a well-rounded citizen.
Exactly. It was about the whole person. But in this new system, that ideal just, it falls into disuse. It seems quaint, inefficient.
And what takes its place? Pure function, utility.
Precisely. The whole focus shifts to measurable skills, to utility. The relationship changes too. Knowledge providers, researchers, teachers, and the users' corporations, governments, they start acting like producers and consumers.
By knowledge commodities.
Yes. Knowledge gets produced to be sold. It gets consumed to be valuable in the next production cycle. It loses what Lyotard called its value of use, the idea that knowledge is good in itself, an end in itself. Now it's all about exchange value.
So learning isn't about becoming a better person. It's about getting a better ROI, a better return on investment.
That's the logic, yeah. And this shift, Lyotard saw, dramatically changes the stakes on a global level.
How so?
Well, if knowledge is now this crucial information commodity, essential for productive power, it becomes the main prize in global competition. Maybe the most important prize.
More important than territory or raw materials. Absolutely. Or even labor.
Potentially, yes. He predicted nations and huge corporations would fight intensely to control information. We're basically seeing that play out now. The digital cold wars, the battles over data, AI supremacy. It's all about mastering information.
Okay, so the old narratives justifying knowledge are gone.
Yeah.
Knowledge is a commodity. The new goal is productive power. But how does the system judge this commodity? If truth and justice aren't the measures anymore, what is?
The new yardstick is performativity.
Performativity. Define that for us.
It's fundamentally about efficiency, optimizing the system's performance, getting the best possible input-output ratio. Does it work? Does it make the system faster, more productive, more powerful?
It sounds purely technological. It is. It's a technological criterion, and Lyotard is adamant. Mm-hmm. It's completely insufficient for judging what's true or just. It bypasses those questions entirely. It doesn't ask, is this right? It only asks, does this enhance performance?
Yeah.
And this relentless drive for performance, for efficiency, Lyotard connects it to a kind of subtle control, even terror. He does, and it's a really chilling part of the book. The core message, the mandate of this technical logic becomes, be operable, that is, commensurable, or disappear.
Wow. So if you or your ideas or your work can't be measured, optimized, slotted neatly into the system's drive for efficiency, mm-hmm. you just become irrelevant. You vanish.
You're rendered invisible, useless to the system. It's a logic dedicated entirely, as he puts it, to the accroissement de la puissance, the increase of power. It's like the algorithm itself issues this ultimatum. It sounds uncannily like the driving principle behind almost every major AI development today. Speed, scale, optimization metrics. Often trumping ethical considerations or deeper meaning.
It maps almost perfectly. And this drive for efficiency, Lyotard points out, isn't neutral. It's directly tied to wealth.
Okay, connect those dots. How does efficiency link to wealth? He traces it back historically. Even thinkers like Descartes needed money for their labs, for experiments. This seeded the realization early on. You need resources to establish proofs. No money, no truth, in a practical sense.
Okay.
And this develops over time into the core equation governing our age. Wealth equals efficiency equals truth. Wealth equals efficiency equals truth. Unpack that. Why does being wealthy make you more likely to be right? Because wealth gives you the power to administer proof. Think about it. If you're the richest player, you can afford the best equipment, fund the biggest research projects, gather the most massive data sets, build and run the most powerful AI models. You can generate more evidence.
Exactly. In a world where truth claims increasingly rely on complex data and evidence, the ability to fund the generation and presentation of that evidence becomes paramount. The wealthiest entity can literally outprove competitors, sometimes regardless of the actual underlying truth of the claim. They control the means of demonstrating truth.
That completely undermines the romantic image of the lone, impartial scientist searching for truth. It makes scientific authority partly dependent on economic power. It shifts the ground significantly. And this logic inevitably reshapes the main institution designed for knowledge, the university. Right, chapter 12, the functional university. What happens there?
If the goal is no longer that holistic Bildung, creating enlightened citizens, then the university's role gets reduced. It becomes functionally subordinate to the needs of the system, to maximizing performance.
So its primary goal becomes
to produce competences, specific, marketable, measurable skills that feed the system.
And the curriculum naturally follows that demand.
It has to. Driven by global competition, universities prioritize fields directly linked to informatics, to what Lyotard termed telematique, that blend of telecommunications and computing, basically modern IT and networking.
So demand surges for computer scientists, engineers, data analysts.
Cyberneticians, linguists, logicians, the people who can build, maintain, and optimize the global information infrastructure, the technical intelligentsia, as he calls them.
And this creates a kind of split within the university's offerings, a definite cleavage. He sees two main functions emerging. First, professionalization, churning out those specialized technical experts the system needs.
Okay.
And the second.
Second is permanent education or recycling. This is about providing useful competencies to, well, everyone else. Often this includes students from fields that are now seen as less useful, humanities, arts, some social sciences. They get retrained, reskilled for more immediate technical application.
It sounds like vocational training for those who didn't pick the right major initially. Even the role of the professor changes dramatically, doesn't it?
Radically. If knowledge is just transmissible information, facts, data points, then machines can handle that. Data banks linked to intelligent terminals can deliver content more efficiently than a lecturer in many cases.
So what's left for the human professor?
The role shifts. It moves away from just transmitting content. The new focus is on teaching the new languages, primarily informatics, coding, data literacy, and crucially, honing the skill of interrogation.
Interrogation, you mean like asking the right questions?
Exactly. Knowing where to find the relevant information in the vast sea of data and knowing how to query the system effectively, that becomes the core competence, more so than actually possessing all the knowledge internally.
Which completely changes the student's mindset, right?
It flips the script. Yeah. Lyotard noticed the student's fundamental question shifts. It's no longer, is it true?
It becomes, what is it for? Or in the context of this knowledge market, is it sellable? And in the context of system power, is it efficient? The quest for knowledge becomes tangled up with the quest for utility, market value, and operational power. Okay, so we've laid out this picture. The old guiding stories are dead. Knowledge is now a commodity judged by efficiency. To really grasp the depth of the crisis Lyotard saw, we need to talk about truth itself. He contrasts two basic kinds of knowledge in chapter 6 and 7. Let's start with the older form. Narrative knowledge. Yeah. Narrative knowledge is the knowledge embedded in culture, in custom, in social practices. It's often passed down through stories, myths, traditions. He calls it compact because it bundles different kinds of knowing together. Knowing how to do things, knowing how to live in the community, knowing how to speak its language and understand its codes. And its authority comes from tradition, from the community itself.
Exactly. It doesn't need external validation or scientific proof. Its legitimacy comes from being shared, from being recited and lived. The community is both the storyteller and the story. It operates in what feels like timeless, immemorial tradition. Okay, then you have the other kind. Scientific knowledge, as described in Chapter 7. How is that different? It's almost the opposite in many ways. Scientific knowledge deliberately isolates itself from other ways of knowing, other language games, as Lyotard calls them. It sets up strict rules.
Rules like?
It demands proof, empirical evidence, logical consistency, peer review. It's inherently critical and argumentative based on refutation and building upon previous findings. It's also hierarchical. There are experts whose consensus matters. And it operates in linear, historical time, building a cumulative body of knowledge.
And Lyotard points out in Chapter 8 that these two forms of knowledge don't just coexist peacefully, right? It's a power dynamic.
A profoundly unequal one. Science, with its demand for proof and universal rules, inevitably looks at narrative knowledge and sees, well, non-knowledge. It dismisses it as fable, myth, superstition, ideology.
Because narratives don't play by science's rules.
They don't submit to empirical testing or logical argumentation in the same way. And Lyotard argues this very attitude science, demanding that all knowledge conform to its criteria for legitimacy, is the deep root of cultural imperialism. It's the drive to universalize one way of knowing. But here's the incredible irony. For science to justify itself, to legitimize its own project, it had to fall back on storytelling. It needed its own grand narratives. Precisely. The two we talked about earlier, emancipation and speculation, they were essentially narratives. They reintroduced storytelling to give science a purpose, a direction, a justification beyond just its internal rules.
So the narrative of emancipation used science to tell a story about achieving justice and freedom.
Privileging the prescriptive language game, what should be, and the speculative narrative used science to tell a story about achieving total truth and understanding. Privileging the denotative language game, describing what is. They were necessary fictions in a way to make the scientific enterprise meaningful on a societal level.
But, as we establish, these narratives lost their credibility. Chapter 10 talks about delegitimation. How did that happen? Partly external forces like capitalism and technology?
Right. The sheer success of technology and market forces started to make the old stories feel less relevant. Efficiency became its own justification, but there was also a crucial internal erosion.
Internal. How so?
It happened when science, or rather philosophy influenced by science, started applying the scientific demand for rigorous justification to science's own foundational claims.
Turning the skepticism back on itself.
Exactly. Take the speculative narrative, the idea of a single unfolding historical process like Hegel's spirit. To make that argument work, you have to presuppose that such a universal process actually exists.
Okay.
But if you apply rigorous skepticism, you realize that presupposition isn't a proven fact. It's just defining the starting rules of the speculative language game itself. You're basically saying, let's agree this story is true so we can tell the story. The foundation turns out to be just another narrative choice, not a hard truth.
This feels like the perfect point to bring in that other source material, Nietzsche's essay on truth and lies in a non-moral sense. Because Nietzsche goes even deeper, doesn't he? He doesn't just question the big narratives. He attacks the very idea of truth and the intellect that seeks it.
He absolutely does. Nietzsche's perspective is bracingly critical. He sees the human intellect not as some noble tool for discovering reality, but as a fragile, temporary, and rather arrogant adaptation for survival.
And its main function isn't finding truth, but...
dissimulation, deception, cunning. He argues our intellect evolved primarily to help us navigate the war of all against all, bellum omnium contra omnes, the natural state of competition and danger. We use it to trick others, to protect ourselves, to get what we want.
Wow. So if our minds are fundamentally built for deception, how does something like truth even emerge?
Out of social necessity, basically. Nietzsche argues humans are weak individually and need society to survive, but constant deception makes society impossible. So out of sheer exhaustion and the need for stability, people make a kind of peace treaty.
A peace treaty.
Yeah. They agree on fixed binding names or designations for things. They create common concepts and rules for language. Truth, in this sense, is simply adhering to these agreed-upon conventions. The drive for truth isn't a pure love of reality. It's a drive for social order and predictability.
So lying isn't just about saying something false. It's about breaking the social contract.
Exactly. For Nietzsche, the liar is someone who uses the agreed-upon words, the valid designations, in a way that violates the convention, like saying, "I am rich," when the agreed facts make you poor. Society doesn't hate the deception itself, he argues. It hates the harmful consequences of breaking the linguistic rules, the disruption it causes.
Okay, but Nietzsche's critique goes even deeper, to the relationship between language and reality itself, the thing in itself. He says language is fundamentally inadequate, right?
Completely inadequate. He describes concept formation as a series of arbitrary leaps, of metaphors piled on metaphors. It starts with a raw nerve stimulus from the outside world. That stimulus gets translated into an internal image, that's the first metaphor, a jump from physical impulse to mental picture.
Okay.
Then that image gets imitated by a sound, a word that's the second metaphor, a jump from image to symbol. Each step is an arbitrary transfer, losing information, moving further away from the unique raw reality of the thing in itself, which remains inaccessible.
So when we create a general concept like the word leaf, what are we actually doing, according to Nietzsche?
We're performing an act of violent abstraction. We're taking countless unique individual leaves, all different in shape, color, texture, stage of decay, and we're deliberately ignoring all those differences. We equate the unequal.
We force them all into one category, leaf.
Yes. We create the concept by forgetting the specifics, by smoothing over the differences. The resulting structure of concepts, logic, and science is what he famously calls a graveyard of perceptions.
A graveyard of perceptions. That's powerful. It's like we build this neat, orderly mausoleum of concepts on top of the messy, vibrant reality of individual experiences.
And we mistake that structure, that conceptual edifice, for reality itself. It becomes our regulative and imperative world, a system of laws and categories that feels more solid and reliable than the flux of raw perception.
Which leads to his devastating final definition of truth.
Truth is nothing but a movable host of metaphors, metonyms, and anthropomorphisms. Illusions, which we have forgotten are illusions. They are metaphors that have become worn out and have been drained of sensuous force. Coins, which have lost their embossing.
Wow. Just worn out metaphors. Coins that have lost their picture. So let's connect this directly to the age of AI, especially large language models. If truth is just this collection of agreed upon but ultimately worn out metaphors.
Then an LLM, trained on basically the entire history of human text.
Is essentially a machine optimized to recognize and reproduce those very worn out metaphors.
Precisely. It's trained, using Lyotard's criterion of performativity, to predict the most statistically likely sequence of words, the most common connections, the most established linguistic patterns. It becomes a master of the graveyard of perceptions, reinforcing the existing conceptual structures.
So it excels at navigating the consensus, the agreed-upon meanings, the coins that have lost their embossing.
It's brilliant at it, but it doesn't necessarily connect with the raw underlying reality Nietzsche talks about. It's a machine built on sophisticated agreement within the existing linguistic system, not necessarily a tool for discovering disruptive new truths that challenge that system.
Which brings us perfectly to the next section. If the dominant systems, including AI, are geared towards efficiency and reinforcing consensus based on these worn-out concepts, how does any real innovation or progress in knowledge actually happen? How do we break out? Hashtag tag 3. Postmodern science, system instability, imperials.
Right, so you have this dominant ideology, particularly in management and systems theory, people like Parsons or Luhmann, who tend to view society as this complex but ultimately manageable self-regulating system. The goal is always optimization, maximum performance.
The performativity principle again.
Exactly. But Lyotard does something brilliant here. He uses insights from postmodern science itself to show why this dream of total control of a perfectly efficient system is actually a myth. Science itself becomes the anti-model for total stability.
How does he do that?
He points to fundamental limits. For instance, he brings up the concept from information theory that information costs energy, meaning that the very act of gathering, processing, and utilizing information requires energy, resources, effort. So the bureaucratic dream of achieving perfect control by knowing absolutely everything about the system's initial state
actually becomes counterproductive.
Yes. The sheer cost and complexity of managing that perfect information overload the system. It leads to slowdowns, rigidity, negative feedback loops, essentially, self-asphyxiation. This gives a kind of scientific explanation for why massive, overbearing bureaucracies often become so inefficient and weak. They drown in their own data.
So perfect knowledge isn't just impossible, it's actually inefficient.
According to this view, yes. And beyond the energy cost, Lyotard highlights major breakthroughs in 20th century science and math that directly challenge the idea of a stable, predictable, fully knowable system.
What are the key examples he uses?
Well, first, there's Gödel's incompleteness theorem. This was a bombshell in mathematics.
What did it show?
Gödel proved that in any formal system complex enough to include basic arithmetic, there will always be true statements within that system that cannot be proven using the system's own rules. There are inherent internal limitations to formal consistency and completeness.
So no system can perfectly capture all truths about itself. It shattered the dream of a perfect, all-encompassing mathematical logic.
Precisely. Then, second, he points to microphysics, particularly the implications of Heisenberg's uncertainty principle.
Right, the idea that you can't perfectly know both the position and momentum of a particle at the same time.
And the broader implication Lyotard draws is that truth at fundamental levels isn't singular. It often resolves into a set of multiple incompatible statements. Which statement is true depends entirely on the framework, the scale, the choice of the observer or experimenter. There's no single objective viewpoint that captures the whole picture simultaneously.
So reality itself is, in a sense, observer-dependent at that level.
Or at least our description of it is. And third, he looks at the emerging mathematics of chaos and instability, things like Mandelbrot's fractals and René Thom's catastrophe theory.
What do those show? They focus precisely on the things stable systems ignore. Irregularities, discontinuities, sudden shifts, complex patterns arising from simple rules. Fractals show infinite complexity hidden in simple equations. Catastrophe theory models abrupt changes, like how a dog's behavior can suddenly flip from friendly to aggressive due to smooth changes in underlying factors like fear and rage. These aren't predictable with simple linear models. So the cutting edge of science in his time was revealing a universe that's much more unstable, unpredictable, and complex than the neat, controllable system imagined by the techno-managers.
Exactly. Postmodern science, by deliberately studying these limits, the undecidables, the paradoxes, the chaotic edges, actually serves as the counterexample to the ideology of total systemic control. Its real function isn't just confirming the known, but actively producing the unknown.
Pushing boundaries, exploring uncertainty.
Yes. And this leads Léotard to propose a radically different goal for intellectual and scientific progress, moving away from the ideal of consensus.
Away from consensus. What replaces it?
Paralogia.
Paralogia. Okay, what does that mean?
If homologia is agreement, consensus among experts within the established rules, paralogia is about invention through dissent. It's about actively seeking out the paradox, the counterexample, the move that breaks the current rules.
So genuine progress doesn't come from everyone agreeing.
No, it comes from the disruptive move, the unexpected idea, the challenge to the status quo. And then, crucially, legitimizing that new move by proposing new rules for the language game. Progress requires constantly questioning and revising the rules themselves.
That's a really powerful idea. It suggests that dissent isn't just tolerable, it's essential for knowledge to advance.
It's the engine of innovation. Léotard argues that the pursuit of universal consensus, an ideal championed by thinkers like Habermas, is actually insufficient. Worse, when that drive for consensus gets co-opted by the system seeking performativity.
It just becomes a tool for control.
Right. The system loves consensus because consensus is stable, predictable, manageable, efficient. Dissent is messy, unpredictable, inefficient. So the system, driven by performativity, will naturally try to suppress paralogy and enforce consensus.
But isn't there a danger here? If we privilege dissent and paradox, doesn't that risk leading to fragmentation, chaos, maybe even the inability to agree on basic facts? How can a society function like that?
That's the standard objection, the fear the system uses to justify demanding consensus. But Léotard flips it. He argues that true political terror doesn't arise from dissent itself. It arises from the system's response to dissent.
How does he define terror?
Terror is the efficiency derived from the elimination or the threat of elimination of a partner outside the language game.
Okay, break that down.
It means the system exerts terror when it says, play by our rules, fit into our categories, be measurable by our metrics, or you will be silenced, ignored, defended, eliminated. It's the logic of adapt your goals to our ends or else. The ultimate threat is erasure from the game.
The threat faced by any knowledge, any person, any project that can't demonstrate its immediate efficiency or translate itself into the system's required data format.
Exactly. But Léotard finds a source of resistance, or at least complexity, in the actual nature of society. He doesn't see society as a unified system. He sees the social bond, the social fabric, as this incredibly complex, messy, heteromorphic texture.
Heteromorphic, meaning?
Made up of many different forms. It's a vast network of countless overlapping, intersecting, often conflicting language games, scientific, narrative, ethical, aesthetic, technical, political, and so on. Each game has its own rules, its own criteria for legitimacy.
And the crucial point is that you can't judge one game by the rules of another.
Precisely. You can't use scientific criteria to judge the validity of a poem or aesthetic criteria to judge a legal ruling. These games are fundamentally incommensurable. There's no single master language, no meta-narrative that can encompass and regulate them all.
So if society is this patchwork of incommensurable language games, what does that imply for justice?
It means that a just society must respect this heterogeneity. It must acknowledge the irreducible differences between these ways of speaking, knowing, and valuing. The goal can't be to force everyone into one single game or one totalizing consensus.
So justice isn't found in universal agreement.
But in finding ways to navigate the disagreements, the differences, the dissents, without resorting to terror. Léotard suggests the path forward is towards a practice of justice fundamentally linked not to consensus, but to dissent. Respecting the paralogical move, the minority voice, the game that doesn't fit.
Which brings us right back to technology, to informatics, to AI. It sits at this critical crossroads.
It absolutely does. Informatics, this whole infrastructure of data, algorithms, AI, it's potentially the dream instrument for enforcing total control, for maximizing performativity, for realizing that systemic terror of be efficient or disappear.
That's the dystopian path. What's the alternative?
The alternative path, the one aligned with justice and paralogy, is where informatics serves dissent, where it empowers different groups, provides access to information, facilitates discussion, enables challenges to the dominant narratives. The technology itself might be neutral.
But how we choose to deploy it, who controls it, and who has access that determines everything. It dictates whether we build a system of control or a platform for liberation. #tagoutro.
Well, this journey through Lyotard has been incredibly illuminating, trying to connect his thinking from 1979 to everything happening right now in 2024. It feels like we've seen these major shifts crystallized.
Yeah, first, that fundamental loss of faith in the big overarching story is the meta-narratives of progress and emancipation. Mm-hmm. They just don't hold water anymore.
Second, the rise of performativity as the dominant logic. Knowledge becomes a commodity, measured purely by its efficiency, its usefulness to the system, increasingly processed as quantifiable data. And third, that deep crisis of truth itself. We're grappling with Nietzsche's insight that maybe we're just operating with worn-out metaphors, and Lyotard's showing how science's own foundations are maybe less solid than we thought, leading to the crucial alternative he proposes, paralogy. The idea that real progress, both in knowledge and maybe in justice, comes from dissent, from challenging the rules, not from seeking comfortable consensus. It's about embracing the unknown, the unexpected move, as the only path that doesn't inevitably lead back to that systemic terror of enforced conformity.
So thinking about you, our listener, living in this world saturated with AI, with systems designed to optimize, predict, and often control based on efficiency metrics, what's the takeaway? What's the practical implication of Lyotard's thought?
He offers a surprisingly direct, almost simple principle for steering technology away from the path of terror. It's about access.
Access to what?
The public must have free access to memory and data banks.
Free access to the information, to the data that fuels the algorithms that inform the decisions.
Yes. Lyotard argued that if everyone can see and use the data, if information isn't hoarded as a tool of power, it changes the nature of the language games. They become non-zero-sum games.
Non-zero-sum, meaning?
Meaning that one person gaining knowledge doesn't mean another person loses it. The stakes, information, knowledge are potentially infinite and inexhaustible. Freeing access allows knowledge to circulate, to be combined in new ways, to spark more ideas, more connections, more paralogy. It prevents knowledge from being solely a weapon of the powerful. So the provocative thought Lyotard leaves us with, the critical question for you navigating the age of AI, is really this. In our incredibly data-rich, informatized world, what kind of society are we actually building?
Are we prioritizing a policy driven purely by power, efficiency, and control?
Or are we trying to build a society where the quest for justice, for fairness, and that equally important quest for the unknown, for dissent, for the truly new idea where those desires are given equal weight and respect? Finding that balance, Lyotard suggests, through radical transparency and a genuine commitment to hearing dissent might be the only way to keep liberty alive in an age obsessed with the algorithm.